My name is May Ellensary, and this is Lauren Graber, and we're so excited to be here today to present to you on Ethical Dilemmas in Short-Term Global Research Experiences, the Role of Case Studies. And we'd just like to say that this presentation and the following work came out of kind of a group of students of us kind of discussing with each other the frustrations we had being engaged in short-term research experiences. And from those conversations, we decided to approach several faculty members to discuss these issues, to write about these issues, and to come up with solutions for addressing them. And so our co-authors on this work is Audrey Provenzano, who is also a former Yale medical student, Dr. Michelle Berry, who's currently Dean of Global Health at Stanford University, Dr. Ashgar Rastegar, who's Director of International Programs for Yale School of Medicine, and Dr. Kaveh Khushnood, who is Professor of Public Health at Yale School of Public Health and also runs the International Fellowships for Health Professional Students. And we have no relationships to disclose. So we're going to be really focusing in on the student perspective with regards to short-term global health research and its ethical challenges. So we'll talk a little bit about the current state of global engagement or disengagement, as we believe it is, in terms of student research collaborations. Scrutinize a little bit the value of short-term experiences. Discuss the ethical dilemmas faced by students, and really the focus of our presentation will be these case studies, and we'll end by offering some recommendations. And just a quick note about terminology, we use the term host institutions to refer to the cooperating institutions in the Global South who host students. And although we are focused on the experiences of U.S. medical students and have taken our case studies from our peers at U.S. institutions, we refer broadly to the Global North and South in the presentation. So global disengagement. There's increasing student interest in global health, as everyone is well aware. And we really feel at many institutions, certainly at Yale, it's really students who are calling out for more experiences and more opportunities, and schools have kind of been reacting to student interest and initiative in this arena. As a result, there's a lack of formal global health curricula at many institutions. At Yale, when we arrived, there was just the beginnings of a global health curricula. As a result of the lack of formal global health curricula, there's also a lack of pre-departure training for students who are going abroad to undertake research in low-resource settings. And in addition to the inadequate pre-departure training, there's few opportunities for students to undertake case-based training in research ethics. I think it's important to just take a moment to kind of examine the value of short-term experiences and kind of ask the question, are short-term experiences ethically defensible when it costs a lot of money to send a student away for 2 to 3 months? And while we go away with the highest expectations and hopes, realistically, the research that comes out of that might not be mind-blowing or revolutionary in the field, although very important for global health training. And these opportunities have, I think, very adequately been described as one-way opportunities where the focus is really on the benefits for students from the Global North who are going to these under-resourced settings. And it's reflected also on the research on global health electives. All the research documents the benefits for students from the Global North, that there's increased interest in volunteerism, increased interest in humanitarianism, that these experiences positively influence us to choose careers for the underserved, which is all wonderful, but there's a lack of perspective and about the needs of host institutions, and are there benefits for them? Are there burdens for them? And it's important to kind of recognize that paradox, that this disproportionate focus on benefits for visiting students may kind of reinforce a lot of the same inequities in wealth and healthcare that these programs actually seek to address in the first place.
So as May has discussed, we as students came together to talk about our own short-term research experiences and develop these cases that we'd like to share with you and that we think are really present a good forum for student exchange about these difficult abstract topics. We have four case studies that we'd like to talk about today, and the first one is called Research Priorities, Who Decides? This is Chris. He's an MPH student, and during the summer break that he has between his first and second year, is really excited to study HIV somewhere abroad. He works really closely with his U.S. advisor and develops a proposal, and his research advisor even connects him with Dr. K, who's a physician in Vietnam. And so Chris works on his proposal, it gets completed, it gets passed, he's funded, and he approaches Dr. K about the study. And when he does so, Dr. K is really hesitant about the project and says that, actually, I feel like my patients are really concerned about all the research being done on HIV. They feel that only patients who are HIV positive are getting any of the benefit of this international research. And what Dr. K recommended that Chris actually do is a project in chronic heart disease, because that's a growing concern for the community. So Chris came away from this discussion feeling really, really frustrated, because he put in so much time into this proposal, and he felt like his professional goals were really consistent with this HIV project that he'd developed. And as you can imagine, this is a really difficult position for students to be in. And we really encourage students to question themselves, is this research opportunity that I'm pursuing, is it to better my own experience, or is it to benefit the community where I'm going? And are there ways in which it can really be both? So it doesn't happen as often as we'd like that research projects are developed with input from local partners. And this comes to broader issues where research priorities and topics from the global north are identified and imposed on communities in the global south, in that institutions from the global north and from the US are developing research questions and funding streams that really direct where that energy and research will go, as opposed to stepping back and trying to understand what are the larger health issues and concerns going on in this community. And this has been referred to as a form of neocolonialism, which is exemplified by the lack of developing countries having first authorship on papers or sitting on editorial boards or journals. And this is also exacerbated further by students who then go and hire many research assistants in the country where they're doing research, and then those people aren't identified as part of the research team and aren't included in that process. So we really think it's important for students early on to embed these understandings of community consultation into their research, that students receive some introduction to community-based participatory research prior to developing their themes, so that they can better understand how to mitigate and adapt their own research policies into the needs of the community. This would also be beneficial for students to have specific guided funding about how their research should be formulated. And what that means is a sense where they're required by funding to have to show that they have true collaboration with a research partner on the ground. And that further institutionalizes this as an important concept for all the organizations involved, I should say. And formal partnerships between the institutions is another really important step in this, because it provides a structural framework of a relationship between the entities involved and can help familiarize students with the real needs of the community. Our second case focuses on informed consent. And this is about Amina, who is also an MPH student. She travels to Egypt to study lead poisoning for children. And she works closely with her Egyptian advisor, and the two of them hire several different Egyptian research assistants to perform the interview portion of the project. And while the project is underway, Amina realizes that the research assistants are often glossing over or paraphrasing parts of the informed consent, which she finds troubling. And so she approaches one of them and she says, "We know what's going on." And he says, "Well, if the parents knew all the risks of this project, they'd never do it. And they're only allowing their kids to do it now because they think that their kids are going to get better care because with working with the foreign researchers than they are already." And so they understand enough. And you can imagine Amina feels really concerned about this, and she wants to approach her Egyptian advisor, but feels he's really burdened by clinical responsibilities, and she's concerned about approaching him further. And then she wants to approach her US advisor, but he's really anxious and eager for this data to come through quickly so that a publication can come through also more quickly. So this is another concerning situation. And I think for a student in any country, if you feel like you've come upon an ethical dilemma and you can't approach a faculty member or someone for guidance, that's very concerning. But what we also really try to target in this case is an idea of informed consent and the value and role of this in different cultures, and also how we can couch communities' hopes and expectations in the realities of what researchers are bringing to a position, especially in short-term research. So it's really important for students to consider informed consent in the process and in the context of culture, and how can we meaningfully consent patients so that everyone is truly on the same page. further cultural competency education early on so that students are prepared to have to discuss ideas of informed consent, we believe is really important. And partnerships, again, in this situation are very helpful because, again, they lay that structural framework and encourage students to have dual IRB approval so that they both are getting support from their home institution but also from the host organization, and specific guidelines are outlined for them prior to them starting the research about what different things are needed in the community.
So our third case is called Burdens on the Host. So it's about an MD, MPH student named Ching who travels to Indonesia to undertake a research project. It's the first time that this clinic has accepted visiting students, and they're excited about this new partnership. And so the physician running the clinic spends a lot of time arranging for Ching's stay, getting her visa done, arranging for all the paperwork, arranging transportation, figuring out where she's going to stay. Ching gets there on the ground, and she's she's really relying a lot on the physician to help orient her to the clinic and help her with all the cultural and linguistic barriers and get people enrolled in her study, and asking for a lot of help from the local staff. And the local staff are getting a little bit aggravated because the physician is spending 1 to 2 hours away from clinical care to help orient her. And then soon enough, it's the end of the summer. Her project's barely started, and it's time for her to go back to her home institution. And she just feels like she's been a horrible burden in this clinic and that she hasn't really gotten meaningful research, and comes back feeling pretty bad about the experience. And I think many of you in the room who are more advanced in your careers maybe don't remember that feeling, but I think it's a common feeling among students that you go into projects with the highest expectations and hopes, and then by the time you get your project underway, it's time to go, and you worry that the community got nothing out of you being there, but you had a really awesome experience learning how difficult research is. This points to the culture and linguistic barriers that students face, and it also alludes to the lack of pre-departure training in terms of students not really being required to get training in local culture, and also there not being language proficiency requirements for students going abroad to different settings. Logistical planning is a huge burden on host institutions, and often academic institutions in the North don't take the brunt of that logistical planning. It falls to already overburdened staff at host institutions in the Global South. And as the case alluded to, is it ethical to have impose these burdens on staff and a local health system that's already overburdened in terms of caring for patients? And kind of what can be done to mitigate the impositions on staff already overburdened? What kind of administrative supports could be put into place by academic institutions in the North? And so it's important to acknowledge the power dynamics of these partnerships, so that while, this clinic in Indonesia may feel like, it was really a bad deal for us to have the student here, they're probably going to be reluctant to address the burdens that were placed on them, because they're excited about this new partnership and they're hoping that by having students there, in the future it'll bring more resources and more partnership. So it's important to acknowledge that there might not always be the opportunity for dialogue about this. And all of this, of course, is exacerbated by the short-term nature of student research, that what can you really do in 2 months by the time you get your research underway if it's a summer project. So our last case is called Distributive Justice, and it's about Chris, who is an MPH student who travels to Uganda to do a project on TB. He arrives and he's outfitted with all his N95 masks, and so he arrives to this hospital ward and he's wearing his mask, and he looks around and he realizes that no one else has an N95 mask. So he's feeling kind of awkward, but he's still rocking out in his mask and doing his study, and he approaches one of the local healthcare workers and says, "Hey, how come you guys don't wear masks?" And the healthcare worker says, "We ran out of masks after the last outbreak, and we've just tried ventilating the room, and we're just really hoping there's not going to be another outbreak." So Chris is feeling pretty awkward, doesn't know what to do, but still wearing his mask. And one of the patients in the study becomes diagnosed with cavitary XDR-TB, which is a particularly contagious form of the disease, and he feels really relieved that he has his masks and he's at lower risk for this. But he's feeling really awkward about being in the tenuous position of having these resources that none of his partners on the site have. So I'll just begin by defining distributive justice, which is a principle where both the harms and benefits of research are equitably distributed, and thus not adding further burden to already vulnerable groups. And in the setting of research, just pointing out that those who are participating in the research should also benefit from the research. And we think that this principle of distributive justice should also be applied to access to protective gear and post-exposure prophylaxis in research settings. And that while host institutions and academic institutions in North do have the responsibility to provide for the safety of their students, there should also be a thoughtful policy in place regarding equitable distribution of protective gear for all people involved in the research project, and where it's unfeasible to provide for all healthcare workers at a site, to at least have a thoughtful dialogue about what that means, so that students don't feel that they're perpetuating inequities on the ground.
And so as we thought more about these case studies, we developed a list of recommendations that we had for our own institution, Yale, and that we thought may be beneficial for other institutions as well. The first is utilizing these case studies. We think this is a really unique way for students to engage in a dialogue about ethical concerns in short-term research, and especially for them to learn from other students' experiences, that they won't make the same mistakes as their predecessors. And so we hope that this can be something that students can use before they go, that this can be that they can engage with each other to really further explore how their own reactions and how they would anticipate themselves reacting in these given situations. And then we hope that also in the development, in the very early development of their research project, that it'll help them develop more thoughtful proposals and more ethical research projects. So we think, so like I said, this would be a really great part of a pre-departure training, which we think is a really important aspect for schools. And this is something that we don't have at Yale, despite the multitude of different places that students can get funding to do international research. And I think that that's the case at other institutions as well. And so we really would recommend this. And indeed, the Canadian Medical School Accreditation Board just recently required that all schools, in order to receive accreditation, must have pre-departure training for all short-term global health electives. And we think that that's a really, really great step in supporting students. We also think pre-departure training wouldn't be complete if it didn't have cultural competency training that included a discussion of the social and cultural influences on health, how that changes health systems and delivery, and then encouraging students to use those thoughts and use those concepts in developing interventions and in a more community-based and relevant manner. And this, in combination with the basic language instruction, just recognizes the burden that's placed on host institutions for students who are coming for short-term research. And we also think that in studying specific diseases and conditions, it's really important for students to have an understanding of the broader demand and disease burden in communities, so that they understand how their projects fit into this much larger system. And so, as I mentioned before, community-based research we think is a really important thing for students to have, that they understand how to work within communities to develop projects that are truly driven and relevant to local communities. And then, both at the beginning and the end of their research projects, that schools require that they have explicit means of disseminating their research so that the benefits at all ends are conveyed to the population.
So an important component of student preparation is having mutually beneficial relationships between North and South. So we really believe that having mutually beneficial partnerships between universities and host institutions would help mitigate a lot of these ethical dilemmas. Part of an equitable collaboration would include commitment to mutual opportunities for exchange training and professional development, so that these are no longer one-way opportunities focused on students from the Global North, but are rather bilateral opportunities that focus on professional development for students from both the North and South. Accordingly, there should be adequate compensation for hosting institutions for all the unaccounted costs that go into hosting students, and that these should really be recognized. And, you know, we're hopeful with the combination of adequate pre-departure training, mutually beneficial relationships, and adequate compensation that student research can help develop an infrastructure for the ethical and equitable training of researchers from both the Global North and the Global South. So this is a list of publications that have come out of this work, and we just want to acknowledge Dr. Sam Laboga on the Faculty of Medicine at Makerere University in Uganda for his insights and feedback on this work.
Thank you.